This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Memorial Day weekend as we honor every man and woman who has ever been killed in the service of our country. For our Gold Star families, every day is Memorial Day, and that's often the case for those whose role in war is to try to save the lives of those who were wounded in action. My grandfather was a decorated doctor in World War II, but the Silver Star and Bronze Star he received were never what consumed his thoughts and dreams and flashbacks. Instead, it was the memory of those men he wished he could have saved. If you've seen the award-winning film Hacksaw Ridge, you have that line from Medal of Honor recipient Desmond Doss, who famously saved 75 men on Okinawa in April of 1945. "Lord, please help me get one more," he prayed repeatedly during the course of his heroics. Like Doss, Zeke Mulder had been raised in the Seventh-day Adventist faith. Like Doss, that's what steered him toward the medical side of combat. Mulder would be decorated for his efforts 75 years ago this weekend, trying to save a hero who ultimately could not be saved. But as we're going to hear, something else he did contributed to 10 lives being saved. Before we hear that story of the Japanese Giretsu attack on Okinawa's Yantan Airfield on May 24, 1945, let's hear about Zeke's arrival on the island on the first day of combat there.
It turned out so different than what they anticipated. They thought that Okinawa would be a bloodbath, and it was, but it didn't happen on the beaches. I woke up on April 1st, it was April Fool. Here we were already up against the shore. The LST had dropped the door, the ramp that drove up into the ship itself. They started unloading, and the first vehicle off was a what they called a 10-wheeler. They drove off. The front of the truck dropped in a big hole, and the guys that were driving the truck, there were two of them. One was driving, the other riding. They were sitting in water up to their waist. That's how. Then in other words, the truck was just heading down into the water. So we had to pull up the ramp. They drug that truck out. And then we had to move. So we were kind of sitting targets at that time, too. But there was no opposition at all. I stayed on the ship till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They wanted me on the ship, so they had a corpsman on the ship. The other guys had gone ashore already. So at 3 o'clock, they let me loose. So I rode a duck. I called it the duck. But anyway, there were two guys driving the duck hauling material and whatever ashore. And so they said, "Well, get in." And I just got in, and when we got ashore, they were going to go down the beach, and I was going to go right up the hill to the airport. So they let me off, and then I started walking, and I was the only one there on the beach.
What were you thinking? I imagine there's a lot of different things that could be going through your mind. What do you think was going through your mind?
I really didn't anticipate what would happen, and I, for some reason or another, I wasn't worried. And I look back on it now, I thought, well, my goodness, I'd be fretting and everything else. Here I'm all by myself, and but I didn't, maybe I don't worry enough. But
if you were a corpsman there at Okinawa, you could have been assigned to handling Marine Corps casualties on the ground, some of the infantry units, of course, Army units were there as well. But you were on a crash crew. Tell me what that meant.
The planes take off in groups of two or three at a time. If something goes wrong, then to save the pilot or, to take care of the situation, you have a fire crew, you have an ambulance on the line, and so that was your duty, was to sit there and watch the airplanes land and take off. And basically, our main concern was if planes have been shot up, and when they come in and they crash, then you want to save the pilot.
Sure.
And so I was the ambulance driver. The CO or the doctor that was in charge of us, he said, "I don't care how fast you go," but he said, "I want you to be the first vehicle next to that airplane when something happens, you can't really do anything for about 10 minutes till things cool down. But he said it induces the morale of all the people that see this going on. They say, well, help is going to be there if I have problems.
Sure.
Well, that was my duty.
And how frequent of an occurrence was that you would have to race out to the runway to tend to a wounded Corsair?
You know, we were fortunate. We really didn't. We lost a couple pilots in the landing pattern. In other words, they would stall out, and we lost a couple pilots that way. But we really didn't have that many crashes on the runway itself. We had a privateer, which was a Navy bomber, and they couldn't get the wheels down. And so when we got down at the end of the runway, and when we were behind the airplane, and so they landed with the wheels up, and the belly of the airplane it had a high wing on it, a four-engine, but it had a high wing.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys that were inside of it, they hung on to there were things that they grabbed on the top of the airplane or on the inside of the airplane. And they all lifted up their feet, and the only problem was that when they hit the coral, and the coral was shooting up, and so they had, they were kind of like they'd been peppered with a buckshot on their butt.
And you got to tend to them?
Yeah, we just, well, you know, a little mercurochrome and iodine here and there and whatever. But anyway, that's what the crash crew did. And I got the man out of the tower, but I actually saved at least 10 guys' lives, because during that action that night.
Well, let's talk about this, because now what you're talking about is the incident that earned you the Bronze Star, and it did involve a man in the tower that you carried down. But I'll let you pick up the story from there. What you remember about that night, how did you save 10 men's lives, and then how did you carry a man down the stairs on your back? Because that doesn't sound easy either. So I'll let you take it from the top.
Okay, well, then I'll try to. Okay, the Japanese, they called it kaiutsu or something. It was just a suicide group of planes that were going to land on the runway, and then they would jump out of the airplane and then start with satchel charges. They would tie them to as many airplanes that were on the ground as they could.
Mm.
They got that night. They got 19 airplanes.
Holy moly!
Before there were only one plane was successful in landing and discharging the guys that were in the Japanese.
Right.
But anyway, let's go to the guy in the tower. When they landed, crash landed, he had a light, a real bright spotlight that he'd turn on to signal the airplanes that they could land or take off. It was a signal like light, but it was very bright and very, very intense. And so he shone that light on that airplane with these guys. See, it belly landed, so it skidded.
The Japanese airplane.
And he shone the light on them, and one of the Japanese shot at the light. And, of course, he didn't get the light, but the pilot, the tower operator for that night, it hit him right in just below your rib cage.
Mm.
And it missed his heart, and it just, you know, and it was a wooden bullet. At least that's what they told me later, that it was a wooden bullet, because when it went through him, there was just a little hole where it went in, but where it came out, it was probably, as big as a grapefruit or something like that, just in his back. So here I get up there, and I was trying to help him and trying to, because he was still conscious and he was okay. Well, he wasn't okay, but he was wounded. But I tried to kind of patch him up as quick as I could and give him morphine and that was one thing that we were learning to do, is to try to take away the pain right away. But anyway, I gave him the shot, and then I got to checking him over, and I saw that there was no way that I could do anything really to help him there, because it was just too bad of a situation. I didn't have enough. So I thought, I've got to get him out of here. And just about then, one of the other corpsmen finally came up the ladder. Now, the tower was about 30 feet high. It was made out of wood, and it had a wooden ladder that went up.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, how can we get him down? And so I thought, well, the only way to get him down is to carry him down. And I didn't want to drop him, or if I got shot or something, I didn't want to drop him. And so we had a rope there that they would carry stuff up and down on, you know, from the tower.
Right.
And I had them tie the rope around him, and then I got him on this other guy helped me get him on my shoulders, and then I just backed down the ladder and got him on the ground and immediately put him in the ambulance. And I didn't know what the best way to get to the hospital would be, and so I thought, well, one of the runways wasn't being used, and the plane wasn't on that one. And so I went down the unused runway, down the hill, got him to the hospital, and there were corpsmen there immediately to pick him up and take him in. And that's the last I saw of him. But the sad part of the story and the thing that I've always regretted is that I couldn't save him. He died towards morning that day. And
it was certainly not for lack of effort or ingenuity or persistence on your part, and clearly that is why they chose to give you the Bronze Star for your efforts that night. You also said that there were 10 lives that were saved in conjunction with the same incident. How did that happen?
Well, see, I got back to the tower, and that's where the crash crew was. We stayed there right by the tower so we could get immediate, instruction from the. But anyway, that privateer that was loaded to go out into the China Sea the next morning was loaded with bombs, fuel, and the whole bit. And they put a satchel charge on that, and it started burning.
Oh,
well,
boy.
A lieutenant came running along there, and he told the guys on the crash crew, get down there and get that fire out. And then he ran on, and I didn't have much authority, but the guys came to me, and they said, Doc, what should we do? Because we knew what was going to happen. It was burning, and we knew how much ammunition and all the stuff it had on it. And so I said, well, don't go. You'll get killed. Don't go. So pretty soon here came the lieutenant again. What are you guys doing? You're supposed to be down there and get that fire out. So then then he went on again, and they said, what should we do? And I said, well, don't go. And they said, well, we've got to. He told us we have to go. And I said, okay, drive as slow as you can. And they took off, and they probably went maybe, 200 or 300 feet, or maybe a little more than that, and that thing blew. And I mean, it was the biggest explosion you ever saw. The next morning, I went and looked, and the biggest parts were parts of the engines. And there was a hole in the ground that you could put a 10-wheel truck in. And if those guys had gone down there, they wouldn't have survived at all. And I felt better about that than the other part. But
wow, I don't blame you. And I'm sure they felt pretty good about it, too, in retrospect.
Well, we kind of looked. Everybody looked out after everybody else. You know, there was really. I was pleased at the attitude of everyone. We tried to do the best we could, and we were all green, and we were all. Most everybody was under 21.
It was a long, long time ago, and you talk about looking out for each other. I get the idea in listening to you share some of your stories that you felt pretty strongly that somebody was looking out for you.
Well, that. That when this happened, it was my folks were asleep at home in San Diego or El Cajon, and my dad woke up and he said, I was just impressed that I should pray for you. And I didn't know that at the time. And when I got home and was telling some of the stories, when he told me that, I thought, oh, my goodness, you know. I mean, I was so impressed. So I feel like all of this thing just fit together into a pattern of the good Lord was looking out after me, I guess. And like I say, I didn't do everything right, but at least he watched over me, and I came away without a scratch.
Zeke Mulder came away without a scratch, but you heard his disappointment that the man in the tower that he tried so hard to save could not be saved. I mentioned that Gold Star hero's name earlier, First Lieutenant Maynard C. Kelly. Now, here's the rest of the story. A native of Seattle, Maynard Carter Kelly had joined the Marine Corps in 1943, and he had already earned the Distinguished Flying Cross, piloting F-6F Hellcats with VMF 533, a night fighter squadron operating out of Yantan on the western coast of Okinawa. Just a week earlier, he was in pursuit of a Japanese plane when he was hit by anti-aircraft fire from one of the American ships offshore. Kelly couldn't make it back to Yantan and had to make an emergency landing at nearby Aishima. On the night of May 24th, Maynard Kelly was taking his turn standing duty watch in the tower when that Japanese Giretsu raid unfolded. And the reason he was posthumously awarded the Navy Cross was what he did before Zeke Mulder came to his aid. This was the only time the Japanese made an airborne landing on Okinawa in the entire battle. As Zeke described, four of the five Japanese planes were shot down, but the one Sally bomber was able to make a belly landing on the runway. It skidded to a stop just about 250 feet from the tower. When Maynard Kelly saw that, he hopped in the radio Jeep parked just in front of the tower and raced out toward the plane armed just with a service revolver. He was actually able to kill one of the enemy commandos before exploding planes chased him back to the tower. That's when he went up to the searchlight. As his Navy Cross citation states, determined to halt the hostile invasion, he fearlessly exposed himself to a merciless concentration of fire to train a spotlight on the enemy aircraft and troops, and skillfully directing the small arms fire of other Marines, continually harassed and ultimately frustrated all enemy attempts to reach and destroy our parked aircraft and vital field installations. Fatally wounded as he persevered in his courageous efforts, First Lieutenant Kelly, by his alert presence of mind, shrewd tactics, and indomitable fighting spirit in the face of tremendous odds, had served as an inspiration to his fighting comrades and contributed immeasurably to the repulse of this abortive Japanese attack, which resulted in the annihilation of approximately 71 of the enemy. His determined initiative and personal valor throughout sustained and enhanced the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. He gallantly gave his life for his country. I've encountered other accounts that suggest Kelly was killed by friendly fire, but you heard Zeke Mulder, who tended to his wound, state not only that it was Japanese fire, but that in this case the enemy was using wooden bullets, which had of course been outlawed by the Geneva Convention as inhumane. Kelly's body was returned to the States. You can visit his grave now at Golden Gate National Cemetery in San Bruno, California. Maynard Carter Kelly, one of the Gold Star heroes we honor this Memorial Day. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, a man whose family believed he had been killed in action. He was just tasting freedom again 75 years ago this week after an ordeal you have to hear to believe. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.